My mother held my hand so tight, tighter than she had ever done before. It was as though she was trying to make sure I wouldn't go anywhere. Just stay right there. Now, admittedly, I don't remember much of our talks around this time. And only speaking from memory, Preston would later tell me that he called me, and when I answered, I sounded so casual and belligerent over the phone. I explained everything to him as though it was a regular Sunday afternoon. Whenever I was done with the phone call, the doctor walked in and began to explain to me in full detail about everything that unfolded. He told me that a deer collided with our armored vehicle. The witnesses that drove behind us explained that Statura managed to hit the deer head-on, as he was supposed to, rather than swerve off the road, potentially make things worse. However, the thing that makes this all an anomaly was the fact that deer actually ended up getting stuck in the wheel well of the vehicle, prompting the Humvee to flip from catching the full-grown buck. The literal coating of the buck was shaved off, and the Humvee itself ended up flipping in midair, ejecting Statura while in the air. The Humvee then slammed on the ground before sliding across the road, inevitably crushing the side of the Humvee on the passenger side. From the perspective of my coworkers that drove behind us, they actually had trouble finding me initially, as they all assumed I had gotten crushed under the weight of the Humvee. All the ammo, gear, and tools that were initially strapped down had been completely scattered and/or destroyed after the impact. Afterwards, he explained my situation how essentially my pelvis was shattered the instant my body slammed on the pavement after ejection. To speak in terms of physics, once I was ejected, I slammed and slid across the concrete, all the while my gear absorbed most of the blow and forcefully flinged off me along with the momentum of the crash. I was in complete shock about it all. And it hurt my mother even more when she was able to hear the finer details of what had happened. I let the room digest in the dreaded but relieved silence and proceeded to ask the most definite question, the only question that mattered. "How is Statura?" I asked without a second thought. The doctor paused for a bit and proceeded to say, "Well, at the moment, he's still recovering from his very fatal conditions, and I can't give you insight due to COVID reasons. However, I can explain what happened to him." The doctor proceeds to talk about how Statura was launched out in midair and essentially swan-dived down and landed in a soft, wet patch of grass. He then told me about the damages that he collected: head trauma, extreme blood loss, shattered leg, fractured pelvis, damage to his teeth, and half his face essentially became inoperable. Compared to me, that suffered a shattered pelvis and some lung damage, Statura made my experience sound like a cakewalk. His face was practically unrecognizable, and thinking about it now, I think it would have done more harm than good if I actually had the opportunities to see Statura in the hospital at the time. After this information was dropped on me, I couldn't help but cry for him. For some reason, my heart ached so bad for him, I was overwhelmed. Though I had just met the guy, I couldn't help but grieve as though I had known him my whole life. I told the doctor thank you and asked if I could have a drink of water between tears. My mom gave me some comfort that day and explained to me how she was keeping in touch with Satura's family, essentially being the middleman for me. After a while, I started to become tired and asked the doctor for another glass of water before I went to bed. The doctor then told me yes, and started to stress to me about a specific button that laid across my body on the hospital bed. I actually hadn't paid much attention up to that point, but he explained how I should press the button if at any point during my time laying there, I felt at all that pain. I was rather prideful at the time, so I stressed how I felt nothing and that on the pain scale, I was sitting at a crispy 6 out of 10, nothing more and nothing less. Believe me, it was a very laughable way of thinking at the time, but the whole point of that moment in my life is the fact that I truly had no choice but to be vulnerable. The times before, I could have my curtain up, or I could betray my bravery and act as though I knew what I was doing. But now, not so much. Anyways, after the pain button was explained to me, I drifted quite easily. I was spiked on all kinds of pills, truth be told, so it was rather hard to maintain a presence. Things melted around me. I found myself feeling like butter. Things went black for a bit, but then I felt something off. felt like someone had placed a 35-pound dumbbell on my hip. It was mildly uncomfortable as I slept, but the uncomfort soon turned into a ramped-up burning sensation. Soon enough, an all-too-familiar stabbing pain crept upon me. Then my eyes shot up. It felt like I had been shot in the leg. I began to groan. I was hot and breathing hard. I couldn't pace my breaths at all, and I was drowning in my own stress and humid sweat. My groans ramped up, and I began to scream. The pain hurt so bad it burned. It felt like someone took a brick and started slamming it down on my hips. It felt surreal, a feeling I had never felt in my life. With my panics and quivers also came my efforts to move. Even the slightest adjustments proved to take a lot of effort. I hadn't noticed before, but I could feel the itchy tape and what felt an awful lot like metal placed all around my midsection. I couldn't move hardly at all. I swayed and screamed. The bed felt uncomfortable. I was propped up on it at an angle. It felt like I was duct taped to an angled chair. Tears welled up as I struggled to think. I felt around my body since it was hard to even move my neck due to the slight movements essentially reintroducing the agonizing pain. I finally found the button and started to press on it sadistically, not really thinking as I cried and pressed it with plea. From the corner of my right eye, the door to my room burst open, and the same doctor from before ran over. He propped me up and showed me his cupped hand, which held a variety of unknown pills. Each one had a different color and textures to them. He swiftly but gently handed me a cup full of water and placed all the pills in my hand. "Drink this now," he said quickly. I didn't hesitate to take the pills. My mindset at the time was to do whatever I needed to do to absolutely knock myself out. The pain was so insufferable that I truly wanted nothing more than to be placed in a coma. Now, I couldn't tell you what exactly those pills were, but whatever they were, man, did they do the job and do it well. Just as the subtle buildup of my violent screams began, so too was the gradual decline of my agony. Before I knew it, the sun shined down on my face, and it was a new day. My mother again was seated next to me. The rest of the time at the hospital was spent trying to get back to at least a functioning state. The doctors would come in, ask what level my pain was at, and would request for me to try and stand up. I'll be the first to say this, and I truly mean this with all my heart. We as a people take walking for granted. I never actually realized just how much effort went into standing up, let alone walking. The first time I attempted to stand, it took the combined efforts of two nurses and my mother to make it happen. Even then, I needed an arm around me to stabilize on the walker. For some reason, I found myself feeling as though I was faking all of this. Now, I know that sounds confusing, and believe me, upon reflection, it really is confusing. But at the moment in time, I had this expectancy to be able to just get up and walk. I felt measly and pathetic as I winced in pain. It felt corny to me, like those TV shows and movies I used to watch. Those characters would always sweat like crazy and try their hardest to walk again, and the whole thing just felt like those scenes. It was all artificial to me. I became angry. I asked if I could lay back down, not only because my meager attempts to stand were failing, but also because that unrecognizable sensation I felt from my hip was truly messing me up. As the days passed in the hospital, my gauge of the situation became more and more clear. There were the uncomfortable tubes that were stabbed and taped on my arm. For some odd reason, I couldn't pee no matter how hard I tried. Trying to sit upright quite literally took me 30 minutes to do. I found myself constantly asking for pills to relieve a lot of the pain. I was overly grateful for everything. I would thank nurses and doctors for even walking through the damn door. Most of my time was spent either eating the hospital grub or conversing with my mom, who would give me updates on a very worn-out sutura. I was, by all accounts, uncomfortably still, something that at the time was very foreign to me. As a reminder, this whole time I've been working in high-tempo environments with really no wiggle room to waste a day. This was an abrupt occurrence, even for a younger me who, at the time, figured I came up with any and all contingencies and potential pushbacks. And then there was the actual wound itself. As the days went by, the more mobile I became, at least on the upper half of my body. So I decided to look at what the uncomfortable and unrecognizable feeling was. I had bandages and clear see-through patches covering a huge chunk of my hip and upper thigh. I could make out through the bandages to see what looked like tight and aligned staples with two stitches near the top. There was stained dry blood surrounding the outer rim of the wound, and a huge plaster of white covering covered the lower part of the upper thigh. I would realize a bit later that it was the exit wound where my pelvic bone once stuck out. It was all crazy to me. I couldn't believe that it was me, that I was handicapped so early. It was funny thinking about it. If I'm starting out like this, then what else is waiting around the corner? I began to ask the doctors when I would be able to leave and head back home. For some reason, I was really missing my own bed. As much as I loved the free food and nonstop Cartoon Network shows, I wanted to dwell amongst the familiar. I was rather impatient at this time. After hearing that Staturo was going to be doing well and that he was going steady, I felt that all my honest concern was expended. There was much concern about my current conditions, especially from my mom, who was pretty much not in the mood for my prideful ways. But I truly wanted out of the hospital. The head surgeon told me that if I was able to lift my legs and at least fold it over my other, he would let me head home. I agreed to the terms and would proceed to fight through the pain to make that very thing happen. So the rest of the time I was in the hospital wrapped up rather quickly. I would get prescribed oxycodone, which I was instructed to take any time the pain would be too great, as well as given cleaning instructions and proper bandages to utilize and replace the old ones when the time came. I was also scheduled for a follow-up appointment, which was placed months away from that time, and also told to call at any time if I were to experience any symptoms. Afterwards, I was placed on a wheelchair and walked out to where a driver was waiting to drive me and my trusted walker back to my 4-hour away base. Now, this whole time, I made it a goal to keep Preston informed about everything that was going on. He was keeping track of times, the distance I was from the base, and how much longer I had until I got there. He wanted to be the one to pick me up at the front base and take me back to the dorms where he and I lived. Funnily enough, once I pulled up to the gate, the person that was waiting on me with a full-on ambulance truck was the amazing lady that saved my life, Ashley Blank. Now, at this moment in time, I was quite vulnerable. As a matter of fact, I was uncomfortably vulnerable. I never cried so frequently as I did in the span of a week during that time. It could have been a number of things, but at the time, I blamed it all on the drugs I was on. Once I finally reached the dorms, Ashley was there to help me all the way there. The whole time, I was grateful for her and felt truly indebted to her. Her and I cried like babies that day. Funnily enough, Preston walked in on us wailing about and was so confused on how Ashley beat him to getting to me. So there I was with my walker, and I slowly paced to my dorm. Reflecting on it now, I didn't really have much in my room. The only thing worth mentioning was my really expensive TV, but otherwise, nothing too crazy. Just a desk and some cologne. I gave Preston the rundown of everything that happened at the hospital, as well as the rundown on the drugs I was prescribed, as well as the bandages. He paid very close attention to everything and joked about the situation a lot. At the time, I realized that he coped through jokes the same way I did when it came to intense situations. In our own way, we were actually telling each other how happy we were that things didn't take a turn for the worst. I felt exhausted. I couldn't fathom how quickly my energy would leave my body after taking a couple steps. I managed to crutch my way from the door of my dorm to the slice of bread mattress. Preston quickly helped me to sit down, and in something I didn't really like, he began to tidy up my dorm. He picked up random pieces of clothing scattered around the floor and folded the clothes, started wiping down my desk and putting things in their respective places. I can recall being quick and embarrassed to see the selfless display. I was quick to anger. "I can fold them. What are you doing?" I looked at him with genuine concern. He would respond with humbleness and continue to navigate my room, turning his attention to make it more spacious. I continued to persist and hammer down on him. After all, I was a very self-sufficient young man, and more than capable of folding my own drawers. Having another guy do it was extremely unacceptable, or at least this was the mentality I had at the time. I began to grow angrier. standing up with my wobbly, frail legs, attempting to grab the current item out of his hands. He isn't my maid, and I shouldn't sit here in this pathetic state when I can manage this on my own. Preston turned to me without a moment of hesitation, but looked deep in my soul and said, "Horn, sit down, or I'll put you down." Once I realized that compliance was no longer on the table, I cautiously weighed my options and carefully concluded it would not be best to go against the 6'3 grizzly bear standing right in front of me with my current conditions. "Do you mind if I take a moment to be truthful and honest? Up until this point, I've always had the mentality of being the helper, a person that was obliged to help in spite of circumstance. I was raised this way. I've always tried to listen in on people's problems, gripes, and complaints. I would volunteer for any and all tasks that others would struggle with. As a matter of fact, I too would vouch to fold clothes and clean other individuals' rooms if it meant they felt better. For as long as I could remember, this was all I knew to do. I'll unfortunately admit, it would often get to a point where I found myself neglecting any and all emotions that I might have been feeling while helping others. I never gave myself the luxury of talking about my emotions or my motives. Who would honestly bother to listen, and who would even care? Most of my problems I'd belittle, call minuscule. This is a very thankless world. Not much is given to the kind, and oftentimes, genuine compassion and care is a rarity. Little of it is praised, and more often than not, ignored or untrusted. Whenever kindness is actually shared and given, it's a beauty because of its honesty and its rarity. Aside from my mother's unconditional love, there weren't many examples of true and honest kindness in my life. It was foreign to me. I didn't really even think I was deserving of such a luxury. As I got older, the color of the world became more stale for me, as I'd fall under the routine of helping others for a time, feel the satisfaction of feeling useful, and then things falling flat after. Indeed, I was in fact stuck with the idea that this is how it was and will forever be. Some might say that I think too small of myself and the world. And to that I would say you're right. I was indeed mistaken for this mentality, as I would soon find out that Preston was a living contradiction to my shallow perspective. Eventually, Preston wrapped up what he was doing, grabbed the remote to the TV, and plopped on the chair to watch some movies. I sat still and upright on the bed, trying my hardest to adjust to the creeping pain coming from my lower stomach and hips. After a time, Ashley left, and it was just us sitting there. We hadn't said much before the next celebrity guest walked in. My chief. I'll give a brief description of my chief at the time, because I feel adding some text to these features will help paint the next scene better. Imagine an older version of The Rock, with a majestic bald look and all. He's about 6 foot in stature, and was a sturdy block by all accounts. He got the tired eyes that showed his work in the military, with the dark circles under the eyes to complete the look. He was stone cold in his gaze, often maintaining a neutral expression. It's hard to see through him. By all accounts, some might say he fit the bill when it came to the military look. No joke, I found myself rather intimidated by him. Not because he was a big dude, but because he always walked around like at any given moment he would just start fighting the nearest person to him. So you can imagine my surprise when the huge box of America was standing in front of my door with a standard casual shorts and shirt dad combo going on. He put on the most unexpected smile and immediately greeted me with a huge sigh of relief. I was completely thrown off. Here was this guy that looked like he could wrestle a bear with his bare hands, approaching me with so much positive warmth. I instantly relaxed and smiled. He continued on to ask how I was feeling and even gave me an update on Satura and his family. Satura managed to come around to the hospital and was informed about everything that unfolded between him and I. This had to be explained because, from Satura's perspective, he was driving 1 minute, and then the next minute, surrounded by his family in an unknown bed with hospital clothes on. After explaining the news on Satura, he then asked if we wanted some food and that it would be his treat. He also stressed just how intense my mother was about getting to me ASAP. Always let out a cackle, thinking about how my chief told my mom that he would treat me like I was one of his own kids. And in return, my mother defensively asked, "Well, how do you treat your kids?" I'm convinced to this day that my mother would have gone through the entire base to get to me. Even the way she was able to hop on a flight to get to me needs to be studied. After the chief left, I finally attempted to lay down on my bed, still not comfortable or used to the metal that resides in me. It stiffened everything that I did. I couldn't even move my legs from side to side, as it would require me to rotate my non-existent hips. I was in complete and utter pain. The only remote comfortable position was laying on my back with my right leg slightly bent and propped. It was the least painful position out of all the options I had. I had to completely turn my neck to the side without moving the rest of my body in order to see the TV. I couldn't adjust the way I wanted to. Even the smallest of movements would require the most inhumane efforts. My spine was strained due to the tension in my lower back and neck. At the time, I played my pain off cool, not really putting up a big fuss about just how badly it hurt. I tried my absolute hardest to not use the pains I was prescribed because in all reality, I hated how I felt when I took Oxy. You see, the doctors told me that whenever the pain was too great, I would have to take 2 pills of Oxy and it would help numb a lot of the pain. Though it was true that the medication did indeed help with that situation, it also left me completely outside of myself. And I mean this statement quite literally. That night, I woke up in a panic because the pain hit me like it did in the hospital. I remember I began to wince and grow in pain. There was a literal heartbeat rhythm pulsing from the pain. The vibrations kicked harder and harder, so I tried my hardest to endure. At this time, Preston would leave the door to my dorm open just in case he needed to quickly run in to check in on me. And I remember that night he vouched to crash on the floor. He heard my groans and quickly ran for the pills to hand to me. I took 2 as desperately as I could, holding my breath and micromanaging my movements in a meager attempt to combat the rhythmic, painful sensations. That night I drifted. That night I free-falled, not into the emptiness of sand, but surprisingly into a dream. I laid there floating, but not anywhere special. In fact, I was floating in my dorm. It was the most detailed dream I've ever had. Everything in the dream was an exact reflection of reality. I scanned the room for a bit, slowly floating up towards the roof of the room as my eyes analyzed everything. My eyes continued to wander until something caught my eye. I fixed my gaze on myself, but it was odd, because as I looked at myself, the delirious man was looking right back at me. I couldn't make sense of it. Did my soul leave my body? Suddenly, the walls began to melt and cave in on me. The room began to spin. I felt nauseated. The way everything spinned around me felt nightmarishly familiar. I became distressed. I wanted this to end. It's like being on a roller coaster ride that I didn't want to be on. I lacked control. I began to scream. The scream was the exact scream from the accident. As soon as I came to this realization, my eyes finally opened, and I was awake again. The scream was so loud in my sleep that I was fully convinced that I had screamed in real life. My head was spinning, and my ears rang. I had a migraine. There I remained, still trying to puzzle together the world of dreams from the world of reality. As time passed, so did my frustrations. My confusion grew. I stared at my hands and checked the finer details of it, the way the wounds and scars from the rough road were starting to heal, how prominent of a color I had on my chipped nails, how bony and dehydrated they looked. A tear began to fall down my face as I studied myself. "I am alive," is all I could muster before I went back to sleep. I lacked knowledge at the time, but this would be my first encounter with PTSD. The next morning was, by all accounts, really, really good. A couple of my sergeants showed up and gave me the rundown of what I would be doing for the foreseeable future. Here's how it went. My old job had this thing called a food train, where essentially a group of people would volunteer to either cook food or bring food to someone who's incapable of cooking or going to grab food themselves. This is usually set in place for those who don't have spouses and or typically live alone. And you bet yours truly was overqualified for the food train. They also said that this would be a time frame of healing. I'd go untouched by work or leadership and spend these days just healing up and going from there. If I ever needed help with anything at all I'd have to do was call one of them, and they would go out and get it for me. I would, of course, never ask this from any of them. So for the next few weeks, someone new would come knocking on my door, ask how I'm doing, and then leave me with a delicious home-cooked meal. I would especially be excited when I found out that a technical sergeant or someone ranked higher would cook, because they were really good at it, perhaps a little too good. I can recall gaining quite a bit of weight from all the delicious meals I'd devour. And Preston wasn't in the clear either. I would often share the meals with him, since he essentially took care of me the whole time I was healing. When it came to keeping up with myself, it was quite the battle. It would take me a combined total of 35 minutes to get myself out of bed, without help, mind you, grab my walker, struggle to the bathroom, and hop in the shower. Getting out of pants would prove to be quite difficult, and throwing on socks would be near impossible. I would go on to wear very loose and baggy clothes out of obvious convenience. And by the time I would shower, crap, and change, my body would shut down on me and I'd waddle back into bed, where I'd disconnect like an old computer. Most days were spent eating a pile of junk food while binge-watching shows and movies with Preston. We'd find ourselves laughing and joking around without a care in the world. During this time, COVID was rampant, so we had to remain quarantined. By definition, we rotted the days away, and yes, we were unapologetic about it. I could confidently say we spent over 100 hours basking in movies and expending the days away. Looking at it now, the movies, shows, and video games were a more effective painkiller than the oxy was. The day finally came where my bandages needed to be changed. I was too weak to even lay a finger near the affected wound, let alone change the bandages of it. I attempted anyway. I slowly peeled the patches back. I could hear the crusts and old dried blood flakes pop and peel with the tape and bandages. The stale and bitter stench followed. I gagged from the foul odor. Eventually, the peeling snagged against the wound and felt one of the staples begin to tug at my skin. I quickly pulled away like a child that just touched fire. The pain was so great that my vision went hazy. I settled down on my bed, trying to catch my breath, and gave my stiffened arms some time to rest. I knew what I had to do, but was incapable of doing it alone. I took a deep sigh and reached for my phone to text Houston, who, ironically enough, was already walking through the door to my dorm. I asked him with restraint if he could do it for me. He looked at me with worry and a sickened look of concern, but like a real champ, accepted the challenge. Now remember, I actually hadn't seen the outcome of the wound after the surgery, only through the clear patches could I make out the staples and stitches. So at the time, it would be an experience for the both of us. Fun fact, my scar runs really long down my waist and into my thigh. It would require me to unfortunately drop my pants rather low to make this whole bandage-changing operation a success. Talk about a true bond. After something that traumatic, of course we would be brothers for life. But all jokes aside, back to the story. Preston managed to get all the bandages and old patches off of me. I knew when he was finished because he automatically screeched in terror, "Dear God!" I quickly looked down to see how my body was holding up. Past the staples and stitches, the scar eventually stopped, and below the scar was my exposed flesh hanging off my body. It smelled something awful, and the sight of it even made me queasy. Preston looked away while gagging like how an old man sounds when he snores. I yelped from the unsightly view and quickly tensed up. The flesh looked old and grotesque. Some blood began to formulate around the exit wound where my bone once laid. I slowly reached down and touched around the surgical area, as well as my wound. The sensation I felt was like static. Not in the tingly sense, but in a literal sense. Everything there was numb. In fact, I couldn't feel anything at all in terms of skin. I analyzed closer to see one of the pins that was placed inside me poking ever so slightly out of my skin. I slowly let my fingers explore. Things started to digest for me. I realized right then and there that a piece of me was forever gone. Preston proceeded to finish everything up and even cleaned around the wound. Nothing really changed with the pain after that. In fact, I'd argue it became way worse. The routine of desperate resistance, followed by uncontrollable sweats and weeping, would ultimately lead me to taking the oxy to help ease the edge. With each pill I took, there also followed the same dream. Some days I would cry without reason. Other days I would ramble and forget all that I said the next day. I was also really impatient when it came to the healing process. I would expect for me to sleep and wake up the next day rejuvenated and back to standard health. This greedy impatience that I cursed myself with would further this creeping frustration I had growing within myself. I became tormented with feeling helpless. Though I knew healing would take time, it was still off-putting to witness myself not being able to do the things I'm normally capable of doing. Simply trying to sit up in my bed felt like I was attempting a muscle-up. I'd often grab my covers and try to crawl and leverage my way up. Walking to the bathroom felt like a running marathon. Seating myself felt like squatting 3 plates on a squat rack for the first time. Putting on clothes was like trying to do complicated yoga positions. It all started to weigh heavy on me. I'd find myself thinking reckless on the things that I struggled to do, oftentimes calling myself helpless and weak. It was a very warped and toxic way of thinking. This would grow as time went on. I felt myself in agonizing pain and irritated with the fact that I was confined to my bed. Even when I got up to do activities, they were in short supply and would quickly lead to exhaustion and muscle fatigue. It became so potent to a point that I would nag and groan in a bratty manner. I remember a specific day so clearly as if it happened yesterday. It was the day the gravity of the situation took full effect. I found myself in this weird position of overappreciation. Let me explain. I failed to clarify that at this point, even the most minuscule acts of kindness towards me would send me in a gracious spiral. My emotions were spiked to 1,000. Maybe it was because of the drugs, maybe it was because of the situation I survived, and maybe it was a bit of both. Regardless, everything was dialed to 11, and even the more minor things would have a great impact on my reactions. This translation of heightened emotion would affect the very relationships I had amongst the people I called friends, relatives, and acquaintances alike. I remember thinking that there would be a lot of people that would genuinely care that I was alive and act on the idea that emotionally I wouldn't be fully present. Ironically enough, even I didn't realize at the time that I wouldn't be of honest use to anyone with how badly I was crumbling. Yet and still there I was, falling back in this old supportive loop that I've always been accustomed to, the role of a helper, hearing other people's problems and trying my damn hardest to supply and be there for them in spite of my own situation. Around this time, my advice would heavily gravitate towards the appreciation of life and not taking it for granted for obvious reasons. For a time, my routine of helping others and getting the quick fix of dopamine from the small thank yous I'd get worked for a time. Until it didn't. Now, this isn't some rant on how you should feel sorry for me, and believe me, I sure as heck don't. But I should have realized that trying to be some supplier for others and to be some fixer would prove to be my downfall. So I would constantly try my hardest to combat agonizing pain, random drops of blood, the delirious drugs, and my new friend PTSD. I also tried to listen to the problems and pains of others. At the time, I'd find myself thinking that most of the issues I'd be presented with were in fact no big deal. I like to quickly add that pain affects everyone differently. This was just the mentality I had during this time frame. The patience I once had to listen to others was in short supply, but I tried my best to continue to be the shoulder people could lean on. I was overwhelmed one day, and I remember so vividly trying to confide in the people that would constantly confide in me. Now imagine my surprise when those very people would quickly brush my current situation off in favor of their own problems. A young me couldn't grasp this problem of failed transactions, failure of fair trade. What was a friend? I can remember this day so vividly. My nagging frustrations from the pain became more grim. Whines became silent despair. Sweaty irritation became a weight of rage. I punched my wall with no real care of anything due to the drowning pain. I slept wrong that day and the pills weren't able to take away the pain like usual. I was awake. I became fully aware. I went to my phone to call people, text the familiar, seek some answer that could help in the situation. My anger grew bigger. The pills kicked in harder. Hallucinations started to come in. I felt there was someone moving from the corner of my eyes. I'd quickly pan and fixate my vision on the silhouette, just to find nothing. My sweats became more frequent. I was cold. I was angry. The people I so desperately clung to didn't reciprocate the shoulder that I gave them. The sun began to set. My thoughts kept running around my room. Why am I alive? I thought to myself. I looked at my hands. I looked at me. I felt disgusted. What a fool I was to think anyone would be capable of understanding how I feel. And honestly, can I blame them? I'd have to live forever like this. I'll forever be in pain, hindered by a failed purpose. What was my purpose? I probably don't even qualify to be a pilot now. They seek peak health for fighter pilots in the Air Force. Why could I qualify? A tear began to form. I'm sick of crying. All I do is sit still and cry. It's a pathetic display. I'm supposed to be strong. I was raised this way. I've never shown emotion this prominent before, at least since I was 8 years old. I picked up my phone, desperately and delusionally searching for a sign of life, an ounce of care. Nothing. It was midnight. I didn't move an inch. My thoughts fogged my rotting body. I laughed as tears fell. I tried chasing my thoughts around as it ran like a fleeting jackrabbit. I tried scooping my soul off the ground as it melted and morphed through my hands. Purpose. I barely started this damn thing and nearly lost my life. What did it mean? I didn't understand. I mean, I prayed for 2 weeks. Did you not hear me? The sun started to rise. And as the sun rose, I began to float and stare at myself. Funny enough, I stared right back. Oh no, I began. Get this off of me. I violently attempted to scratch and smear the literal skin off of me. Tears fell as I rubbed my arms. My breathing was sporadic. My palms felt rough from the friction and sweat. I have managed to put on this grateful, brave face for so long, not admitting to the pain, keeping this mask of pride up for so long. How dumb of me. I laughed and cried in anger, helplessly rubbing my arms as I told myself I hated myself. I pleaded to God, telling him in anger and bitterness to get me out of my own body, like a child turning away bad food. I don't want it. The sun beamed through the blinds of my window. I stared up, but not to look at the ceiling. Actually, I looked even past that. I looked towards the stars. My phone began to ring. It was my mother. The overappreciation I once had was gone. At that moment, I didn't see the bigger picture. And my mother, unfortunately and unrightfully, felt what was the last bit of me. Have you ever heard of the book of Job? Yes, from the Bible, Job. The man who God boasted so much about, his faithful servant. That book always fascinated me, and at the time I never really understood it the way I do now. You see, Job lost everything you could possibly think of, and then some. And he began to look to God that he consistently prayed towards for proper guidance. He was angered. He demanded an explanation and reasons why his entire family was dead. As he prayed in anger, he also spoke to himself that it was somehow karma that this happened to him. And somewhere down the line, this was a punishment that he rightfully deserved. He pleaded to God to take his soul away, to return him to the ground. Now, as a Christian, I've always flinched reading that. To me, I felt Job came across completely disrespectful towards God. His prayers were not positive prayers, so by default, I assumed they weren't pleasing to God. It used to confuse me on why Job, in the end, honored God from the outbursts and complaints he spoke. Indeed, the book has always fascinated me. But there's something interesting in the book that I still think about to this day. It was actually after Job loses everything. He was sickly. He shaved his hair and ripped his clothes, and sat down in the midst of his chaos. His thoughts were like a fog. In the Bible, it says that he sat in silence for 7 days. He didn't speak a word, just sat there. I've got a question. Do you think that while Job sat in silence, He too looked up to the stars. There was a sudden knock on my door. My eyes were smoky black, and they felt so heavy to the point of being swollen. I no longer thought about anything. After unfortunately blowing up on my own mother on the phone, I had nothing else to worry about. My head felt unnaturally clear. Preston walked in with his usual smile and straightforward, bright attitude. I sat in silence as Preston rambled and tidied small things around my dorm. The silence grew louder. Preston glared at me and asked the obvious, "Everything all right?" I remember looking at him and giving him the most stale mm-hmm, not even attempting to make it sound believable. Now, the thing about Preston is, he isn't the biggest fan of liars. He was also a rather stubborn guy. His southern hospitality compelled him to be as stubbornly kind as possible, even when I tried to reject the obvious kindness. He instantly went into serious mode and asked what was up. I could tell he was in no way going to let this thing drop, and so I began to speak the honest truth. I began to explain my skewered revelation on life, a lesson that I currently renounce. I told Preston that I realized that not everyone is actually a friend. I told him that I realize I owe nothing to anyone, and they don't owe me anything. I would go on to despise everything. I found myself yelling at the bottomless abyss of evolution, cursing the aligned purposes of my ancestors that led to the existence of me. I shunned the idea of health and wellness, for I felt as though I wasn't deserving. When it came to those around me and the people that I walked near, I was guarded. I put up a shield so rugged and firm that even I couldn't drop it, even if I wanted to. Yes, in all regards, I was indeed saddened and plunged in cosmic despair, only functioning off the idea that sooner rather than later, I could stand back up on my own 2 feet and hate the world even more. I was misguided and in much need of help. So in the most warming of ways, God answered my childish tantrum. See, the thing is, though the situation I had been in was in all accounts traumatizing, it was in fact pale in comparison to some of these people out there that grew up with nothing, or in fact, lost even more than just a measly old hip. One day I was there watching TV, scarfing my face with factory foods and home-cooked delights. Amongst my sugary sweets, there was a soft knock at the door. My commander, of all people, walked in. Instinctively, I scrambled from my rocker, trying my hardest to render proper customs and courtesies. She quickly realized what I was trying to do and freaked out over the unnecessary display, explaining how I by no means needed to do that. I always laugh thinking about it because I never thought my own commander would pop in at my dorm, let alone in civilian clothes and with her husband. She gave me a cheerful hello and began to do the routine checkup that I was used to hearing by that point. She then introduced me to her husband. Now, at the time, I didn't know much about the guy, only that he had a very intimidating yet gentle presence. It was hard to explain, but the guy looked like something off that American Sniper movie. He was huge like a bear, a beard that would make Santa Claus look like a pubescent that just hit puberty. He approached me and took a hard look at my mess. The first thing he asked was how good I was at walking. I explained how even standing took the utmost strength and that my energy would deplete before I reached Preston's car, which, by the way, was only a couple of steps away from the dorm buildings. He gave a reminiscent sigh and told me, "Ah, I know exactly what you mean." I hadn't noticed before, but the guy was missing an entire leg. My stomach sank. The man continued, "The best way to get back on your feet is trying your hardest to walk around the building. I'll even walk with you. It's how I got better with walking. It helped with the limp too." I quickly asked what happened. As I asked this, I also realized that the man was missing an eye. Before he could give me an answer, I realized that this man had been through something I could only fathom. Before the words left his mouth, I understood his tale. His youth was filled with battles, and the weight of his losses were totaled. I knew that what caused this damage was an explosion, but not just physically, but mentally, spiritually. Before I knew it, I found myself reflecting, thinking of my situation, just how much worse it could have been. This would be my first lesson in compassion, not realizing at the time, but subconsciously grasping the notion that everyone does in fact have a story. people handle and combat life in their own ways. I started to pick his brain, not realizing that the cluelessness of my youth needed the talk of a man with a heavy loss to put things in a positive perspective. Though his pain is verbal, he still manages a smile. Though his toll was heavy, his humor shined through. I learned that day what it meant to grow up. Though this wasn't my breakthrough moment, in fact, things would get worse before it got better. After the encounter I had with the retired content vet, I began to focus all my strength on getting better. Though the conversation was what I needed to hear, I somewhat took things to the extreme and began to have the mentality that my injury was in fact a minor thing, one that could easily be overcome by just putting in effort. Boy, was I wrong. But bear with me, I'm still learning how to walk. No pun intended. So let's start to pick up the pace a bit. The routine never changed. I'd receive a blessing's worth of food from very, very generous people. Preston would come in and do his daily checkup, and we would play games and laugh all night to movies and games. I remember at the time, most days we were spending watching horror films and playing games like Spider-Man. I slowly got better. I managed to get my own socks on, and I started to hold my weight without the support of the walker. Though taking a step felt like another battle altogether. At least the painful stiffened stab I felt from moving my legs side to side was, for the most part, gone. Preston started to become like my roommate. Most days he'd bring a blanket and pillow over to my room and just sleep in there for the night. A part of me likes to think that Preston was more worried about me than what he let on at the time. There's a very distinct day I remember. As a matter of fact, I hold this day so dearly to me. He walked in one day from work. I was very ecstatic to see him at the time and began to talk his ear off about the latest game we were playing. Preston paced around my room, folding clothes and cleaning things up the way he normally did. Keep in mind at this time, my room wasn't in all regards messy, but I think he found some comfort with finding something he could clean in my room, regardless of how minuscule the task. Anyways, he cleaned and cleaned, giving me occasional mm-hmms and yes to my drowning antics, laughing to himself as he went through everything. I threw on a movie and slowly shuffled towards the lights to turn them off, not really thinking much of what Preston was doing once he sat down. The movie went on and I began to talk more throughout, again not paying attention to Preston. I had realized halfway through that Preston wasn't saying much that day. In fact, he barely said much at all. I looked over to see him leaned over with his hands covering his face. I called out his name, already understanding that he might be asleep. He didn't budge. I never realized it until that point that Preston had worked a full day before heading to my room to check on me. This moment was important to me, not because of his selfless kindness, which, by the way, deserves its own praise, but because of how confusing his kindness towards me was, to put himself aside in favor of making sure I was okay. I will ponder this the rest of the night. That morning, I got serious with Preston. We rarely have deep-rooted conversations. I asked him, "Man, why do you do all this? You fold my clothes, do my laundry, you clean my bathroom, buy us stuff for the day. You've never bragged about it or waved it over my head. You even changed my bandages without batting an eye." Preston sat back for a moment and deeply pondered my hurried question. I could tell he was thinking significantly about it. There was a distant silence. I didn't want to interrupt him. Preston's deep, stiffened face quickly relaxed, followed by a calm and blunt response. "Because I know if I were in your shoes, you'd do the same for me." It's right then and there that I realized that God sent Preston in my life to be my brother. I will go on and never take his kindness for granted, even to this day. I shower the crazy bastard in praises and gratitude. His boost of gratitude, along with my beginning stages of compassion, would help further my growth and help further my healing process. My mother would eventually come again to cook warm home-cooked meals for both Preston and I. She was so thankful for Preston, practically smothered him with a hug when she first met him. I remember around this time, my walk was a lot better, though I still had a limp to it. I could only manage to travel small distances without the use of my walker. Though the pain still strained me quite a bit, I started to carve my life around the idea that I was in some ways limited to what I could do. I learned to not carry a ton of weight, at least to begin with. I got comfortable sleeping on my back rather than on my side when going to bed. These minor adjustments helped me to sustain the pain. I never really relied on the oxy after my meltdown. I instead take regular pain pills since it was more tolerable and lacked the hallucinations. Summer was starting to end, and as fall began, so concluded my healing process. A total of 3 months altogether. The doctors projected 6 months, and my job wasn't expecting me to be back in shape for another year. I was given the option to medically discharge out of the military, a choice that thankfully Statura took. I, however, decided to decline this offer because at the time I, after all, just started my Air Force career and really wanted to understand my job and opportunities better. A glimmer of me still holding on to the dream of being a pilot. I started to understand myself better after I got back on my feet. I remember Preston and I took a trip to the lake to somewhat celebrate the fast recovery I made. I had hardly been in a car up until then and found myself rather tense and uncomfortable. I was hallucinating extremely bad while Preston drove us. Even the smallest sways and turns would leave me in a heart-dropping panic. I tried to calm myself. It was as though my very soul was now sensitive to the modern senses. When we made it there and took our first steps outside of the car, I realized then and there that the door to death helped me to unlock an altered, deeper perspective to my existence. The air felt thin and sharp. I took a deep breath to inhale the crisp and dry air. The trees around us rustled and seemed to hum as if trying to communicate its movements. The lake danced with blurry blend of blue and beaming glows, like a dancer spinning around with jewelry and pearls. Though the colors felt stale and crude, there was more clarity and sharpness to its portrayal. The faint sounds of the steady lake harmonized with the jagged directions of the wind, like a rehearsed dance. I woke up. Now more than ever, I was hit with a beautiful cruelty. Once the lake trip was over, the rest of that year felt pretty fast. I slowly eased back into my job. At the time, my leadership paid close attention to me and only allowed me to work in the office with them until my follow-up appointment and my full healing was complete. Statura eventually made it back from the hospital, though really it was more like he transferred from one hospital to the next. He was in better shape than what he was, but I was still hurt to see him in the condition he was in. Half his face couldn't function properly, and he spoke with a twitch and some strain as he struggled for his muscles to formulate words. He couldn't completely close one eye, so it looked like it was rolling back whenever he would attempt to do so, and he could barely walk. They ended up putting a full metal plate in his leg and stitches on most of his scars. It was such a heart-wrenching thing for me to see, but I couldn't help but be happy that he was still kicking it, in spite of his condition. I could tell the first time after the accident that he was also fighting his own battle, not just physically, but mentally and spiritually as well. Truth be told, he was unrecognizable, not in a bad way, but his face was truly altered and swollen from everything. I grieved for him. Though I knew he cried behind closed doors, I wanted to share in his tears. Like I mentioned before, he would proceed to take the option to medically get out of the military. And I still think to this day that was a very good call on his end. He's doing well now and striving with a smile on his face. Before I knew it, with my newfound guarded outlook on life and a deepened relationship with my family in Preston, I was back in my gear, fully equipped and awakened at 6 a.m. to start my official job. It was around the October-November time frame, and I threw on my clothes in a hurry. I slept wrong that day, so my leg was quite stiffened. A lot of more minor things happened leading up to this point. My staples and stitches were removed. I learned to run again. I lost some weight. We were questioned about the actual legitimacy of the accident and how exactly it happened. And I finally was able to officially stop taking the oxy. Though I wasn't in top-notch shape, regardless, I was here. Excited and nervous, I scrambled for all my required gear and headed over to my job where I'd pick up where I left off. The people I worked with at the time were actually quite amazed that I was even there. Apparently, rumors about our tragic tale became so renowned that most cops on base knew about the incident. Some of the stories I heard about us started from grounded reality and others being way off the mark. Some people even thought we were dead. To those extremities, I say this. They weren't wrong. Though it hurt to hear, our old selves did die that day, along with the delusional human immaturity we had ourselves equipped with. Though this death was subtle and tragic, through its ashes, new life was growing and blooming within us. As I write this out now, I speak through a firm tears. For the honest truth is, without these ashes, just how little would I know currently? How well could I see life's beauty? How understanding would I be with the human passing? Life itself started to be like poetry for me. I began to see the patterns and constances of God's work in action. As I grabbed the paddle to my boat and began to set a course across the oceans of waves of reality, I would gradually learn and stop along my journey to see myself in the reflection of the great body of water. Inflation increased the value of one's soul, though at the time I couldn't recognize this from my own blind bitterness. I did understand one very true thing amidst the chaos. God wasn't through with me yet. And thus ended the first year, not realizing that the best and worst was yet to come.